Hello, everyone. Welcome to the bonus episode. And Dominic, we are in a hotel lobby, aren't we?
We're not in the lobby.
Well, not a lobby. We're in a kind of lounge, I think. The operative word is lounge. So there is soft music playing in the background.
Yeah.
International businessmen making
important calls.
Yeah. Making important phone calls. And we're doing our episode here. And the reason that we are in Bath is because yesterday evening we did, well, the first in what's going to be a series of shows, because we've got Hammersmith Apollo coming up.
31st of October. I've actually lost track of time, Tom.
we're so discombobulated. And then, of course, we've got our tour down under. So we're not going to say what the shows are about, because
then they won't come.
Well, exactly. But we want to keep it a surprise for people who are coming to the show in Hammersmith and then people down under.
Yeah.
But, I mean, always good to be in Aquae Sulis, isn't it?
Yeah, Bath is looking very fine, I thought. I went to the Toppings bookshop, Tom. You know Toppings?
I know it very well, yeah. I did an event there, of course.
And the Rest is History book was right there on the tables at the front of the store. It's very exciting.
Do you know, I think that relative to the number of people, the quality of bookshops in Bath is the best in Britain.
There's a shop called Mr. B's.
And there's a Waterstones.
And there's a good Waterstones.
This will mean nothing to our overseas listeners, but I mean...
Never does, Tom. Nothing does, so...
No, it doesn't. So what have you been up to apart from coming to Bath and doing our live show?
So at the weekend, Tom, I was in the fine city of Lincoln, great cathedral city.
Because what you weren't doing,
yeah,
what you weren't doing was going on Channel 4's Sunday Brunch.
No, I wasn't.
Which is a breakfast TV show that I went on.
Yeah, and you were really excited about that, weren't you? I definitely saw a WhatsApp from you where there's some reference to the marrow of your soul or something.
Yeah.
You were really looking forward to that. And when I saw you put up a tweet saying, like, I'm pumped and ready, and it was a, I mean, you were wearing more makeup than I think. You were wearing basically the cosmetics department of a department store.
Somebody said you look more orange than Lineker.
Yeah, yes. Yeah. On a Goalhanger podcast, I mean, that is pretty punchy.
Yeah. Anyway, so that's what I was doing, but you were in Lincoln.
I was in Lincoln, exactly. I was coming back from Lincoln. And I was really sad to miss Sunday Brunch.
Lincoln's brilliant, isn't it?
So it's got an amazing cathedral. I think somewhere like, I don't know, Pevsner or Betjeman or somebody said it was the best cathedral in Britain.
And of course, at one point, it was the tallest building in the world.
It was. If the spire had stayed intact, it would have been the tallest building in the world until, I think, the 19th century.
Yeah, because it replaced the Great Pyramid of Cheops.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. It did.
So that's a top pub quiz fact.
There's a great episode to be done about something that happened at Lincoln Cathedral, because Lincoln Cathedral is the origin of the blood libel.
It's not the origin.
It's not.
No, that's Norwich Cathedral.
I thought there was some East Anglian connection.
Yeah, so it kicks off in Norwich.
So why is the tomb in Lincoln, or the shrine? We have to explain what this is.
So the blood libel is the idea that Jews take children and kill them and put the blood into unleavened bread.
That's it, yeah.
And it's obviously grotesque, fantastical, well, libel.
Yeah.
And it's one that tragically is still current. But it originates in Norwich. A boy is found murdered.
Yes.
And the charge is levelled against the local community of Jews. And in part, it's anti-Semitism, but in part also, it's an attempt by the guys who are running Norwich, which has just been built, that they don't have a saint.
It's a drum up custom.
So the boy is turned into a martyr, and they use it to drum up custom.
Why then is the thing in Lincoln?
Because it's a copycat.
Oh, right. Interesting.
And then there's a kind of pogrom in York.
Yeah.
So I think actually it would be rather timely to do an episode.
It would, Tom. Theo, I can see, looking so hangdog at the thought of...
No. I mean, next year or the year after or something. But I mean,
yeah.
It is a kind of grim and horrible story. And I think it always behoves people in England to remember that...
Anti-Semitism has a...
Well, we invented this shocking...
Do you know what, Tom? I've been thinking about this a lot in recent weeks. And we're not the rest is politics, so we won't go too deep into this. But years ago, about 2006, I went for dinner with my agent, Andrew Wiley, very well-known American literary agent. And he said to me, oh, I've had a terrible day because I've been trying to sell a book by Anthony Julius about the history of anti-Semitism in Britain. And he said, I've been going around all these publishers and saying, you can probably hear the international businessman in the background, and saying, you know, will you publish this book? And he said, so many of the reactions really shocked me because I would go to, you know, big name British publishers and they would say, it looks like a good book. But the thing is, there's nothing to say really because there is no anti-Semitism in Britain. And when he told me this story, I'm ashamed thinking about this because I thought, yeah, you're kind of wrong because there isn't really any anti-Semitism in Britain. You know, it's not really a current thing. You know, it doesn't feel like a terribly exciting or relevant book. So that was about 2006. And obviously I was totally, totally and utterly wrong. And one of the things that's really surprised me in the last 10 years, 8 or 9 years, I don't know, is the resurgence of anti-Semitism and the way in which clearly it has always been there, kind of just waiting. It's latent and unreflective and unconscious in so many people.
I mean, the thing is, you laugh when I say everything is Christian and there's this kind of deep buried Christian substratum, but anti-Semitism clearly derives from medieval Christian fantasies that are developed here in England, and they have become global. So it's a part of Middle Eastern anti-Semitism now. It's actually you're much likelier to be Muslims repeating it than Christians today.
Yeah.
But it does originate in medieval Christendom.
But there are two different kinds of anti-Semitism at play, aren't there? So Theo has written down growth of populism ? On his piece of paper. There's obviously anti-Semitism among Muslims. Not all Muslims, of course. Some Muslims. But there's a different kind of anti-Semitism, which is the kind of Zionist financiers, which seems more 19th century.
Yeah, for sure.
The idea of the sort of this lobby, the sinister lobby that is controlling the media and all that kind of thing. And that's the kind that you are much more likely to hear, frankly, in a British, you know, academic common room than a kind of blood libel anti-Semitism, don't you think?
For sure. Well, for sure.
They're kind of entangled, I guess, at some level.
Well, I mean, it's such a sensitive and complex topic that perhaps it's not best suited to a lounge.
How do we get onto this? We're talking about Lincoln Cathedral.
Yeah, but I think specifically the role that medieval English Christianity plays in fostering the most pernicious of all the anti-Semitic libels.
It's a really, really interesting topic. I totally agree.
And I mean, they have a kind of pretty apologetic note, don't they, in the cathedral, to do them credit.
They
have a kind of fragment of the shrine, don't they? And they have a kind of an agreed statement.
Correct. Yes. Yeah, that's right. By a Jewish council or something.
The Jewish Council of Britain, perhaps, and the Bishop of Lincoln or something.
And actually, as far as these statements go, it's actually well judged. You know, sometimes when you go to a museum in London now and the captions drive you bonkers because they're also kind of... It was really well done.
Yeah, I thought this was good. Yeah. So I've also been visiting a cathedral on a hill, Durham. So I was up in my Scottish estate.
The Scottish estates. Yeah. Theo never tires of hearing the Scottish estates. He was actually literally mouthing the words.
But I got the chance to see in the deanery, Durham Cathedral, which is apparently, the dean told me, is the oldest continuously inhabited house in Britain.
Good name drop there.
Yeah. Hanging out with the dean.
Yeah, very good name drop. Yeah.
So that goes back to 1090.
Thank you. That's nice.
They've got cellars, which are Norman.
Yeah.
And they've got a hallway which got boarded over by a kind of angry Protestant. Well, they're all Protestant, weren't they, the deans, after the Reformation. But he kind of boarded it over and they found it about, I don't know, maybe 30 years ago, beautiful fresco of the Virgin. So it's very interesting to see that. But the thing that I was really impressed by, and I just wanted to give a shout out, is that the dean has responsibility for running the cathedral and the deanery is right next to the cathedral. But the Bishop of Durham, the Prince Bishop, who is a secular as well as a religious figure throughout the Middle Ages and quite recently, very, very kind of domineering figure in the Northeast. His seat was at Bishop Auckland.
Oh, yeah.
Which is, what, about 10, 15 miles outside Durham. I mean, it's quite a kind of depressed place these days. It was kind of centre for mining as well.
Yeah.
So it's not industrially what it was. But there's this guy who's bought the palace and is doing amazing things with it. So he set up a whole series of museums. So there was some Zurbarans there.
Okay. Yeah.
And it was Jacob and his 12 sons. So that would include Joseph in his Technicolor dream coat. So he's got a museum themed around Spanish art. He's got a museum themed around art by illustrating kind of the history of mining in the Northeast. But there's a new museum that's just opened in the palace. And I should just pause at this point because Theo has passed me over a note saying bishops have palace, ? Yeah, Theo, bishops, if they're prince bishops, definitely have palaces. But they don't anymore because they've sold it. So I think the bishop has kind of moved into a bungalow around the corner. But the palace has been bought by this, I think he's made a fortune in the city or something. I don't know. But anyway, I mean, he's plowing all this money back into revitalizing the palace and the environs. And he's just opened a museum devoted to the history of faith and belief in Britain.
Crikey. It's a big subject.
So going all the way back to the Stone Age, right the way up to the most recent census and the collapse of institutional religion. But it's some very, very good exhibits. And it just seems a completely commendable project. So just give that a shout out.
I mean, we do sponsored episodes. You've basically given him a sponsored episode for no return.
I'm very happy to do that.
So Theo has been looking increasingly sort of shifty and displeased, I think because we haven't answered any questions. Is that correct, Theo? So, Tom, we should answer some questions.
All right.
Let's start with a nice easy one for you. It's from AC. I think you'll find this a really easy one.
Oh, God. So we've done the history of anti-Semitism, and now AC is banging them out. Who wrote the Quran?
Yeah. Was it Muhammad, someone else, various writers, or God?
Well, I mean, entirely depends on one's perspective, doesn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, if you're a Muslim, you think it's eternal and uncreated.
Right. Is it not dictated by the angel Gabriel or something like that? Is that right?
It's revealed to Muhammad.
Right.
By Jibreel,
right,
the angel, but it's the word of God. I mean, the question of if you're not a Muslim,
yeah,
who wrote it is, of course, a very different question.
Because there's an academic interpretation, isn't there, that is that it's actually written late, much later than we think, like century later or something like that.
So there's a kind of revisionist trend in the study of early Islam,
yeah,
which in the 70s did advance a very kind of radical position that the Quran was very late and that it emerged from what was described as a sectarian milieu, which is basically a kind of what we talked about in the Baghdad episodes, this great bubbling vat of different beliefs and cultural approaches. So Jewish, Christian, Zoroastrian, Roman, Persian, whatever. I think that is not, there are very few scholars who think that now, because actually the strange thing is that the Quran in some ways seems earlier than Muhammad.
Oh,
so there's been carbon dating on one of the very earliest Qurans, and it was dated to the 6th century. So that doesn't necessarily mean that it may be that, you know, they're testing the parchment, not the ink.
Yeah.
But it's still quite strange. But I mean, obviously, if you're not a Muslim, then you have to say, well, where does the Quran come from? And it seems pretty clear to me that it's a text that reflects assumptions that derive from the context of the late antique Middle East.
As we were talking about in Muhammad and so on.
Yeah, so anyone interested in that, do go back and listen to the episode that we did on Muhammad. We talk about that.
Yeah. One more question for you about Baghdad, the Baghdad episodes. It's about battles. Andrew WBF. Really enjoyed the Baghdad series, guys. Oh, that's nice. Which battle was the most consequential to stop the Islamization of Western Europe, the Battle of Tours or Vienna? As these battles are so far apart, so they are what? When's Tours? 751? If I got that right? Something like that, Tom?
Yeah.
That was a very tentative, yeah.
Yeah, I can't remember.
And then Vienna is 1683.
Well, there are two sieges of Vienna, aren't there?
There are.
Because there's also one that Suleiman the Magnificent sends in the 16th
century. That's right, of course. Well, anyway, listen.
And there's a Siege of Malta as well, is another
one. There is the Siege of Malta.
Which is also Suleiman the Magnificent.
That's a good subject for a podcast.
Yeah.
So anyway, when was Christian Europe under greatest threat? Is it ever plausible that Christendom could have become part of the Islamic world order? Tom?
I think it's unlikely. And I think that both Tours and Vienna, the two sieges of Vienna and Malta, are all about an expansionist empire reaching the limits of its expansion.
Reaching its limits.
So it had Vienna fallen,
I
don't think the Ottomans would have been able to maintain their occupation.
Right.
No. And even if the shrine of St. Martin had been sacked, I mean, basically, the Battle of Tours in the 8th century wasn't about an attempt by the Arabs, the Muslims, the Moors, whatever you want to call them.
It's a raiding party, isn't it, really?
It's essentially a raiding party.
Yeah.
They're based in the south of France. They have crossed the Pyrenees. They've set up colonies in the south of France. And they are sending raiding parties up north. And the Shrine of St. Martin is targeted because it's unbelievably rich. It's like the Vikings with the Shrine of St. Cuthbert on Lindisfarne.
Gregor Attor, big fan of St. Martin, of course.
Yeah, of course. So even had Charles Martel been defeated, I still don't think that it would have. So Gibbon famously, you know, it's one of the great counterfactuals. And he says that if the battle had gone differently, then perhaps
the Dons of Oxford or whatever.
The Dons would preach the word of Muhammad to a circumcised people.
Yeah, there is a very big mosque in the centre of Oxford now.
Well,
actually.
Exactly. So.
But that raises an interesting question, doesn't it? A sort of geopolitical question, because when you think about it, no empire has ever commanded both Western Europe and the Middle East, including Persia, including Iran. The Romans, I guess you would argue, came closest, but nobody has ever, I mean, the sheer geographical distance and whatnot, it's hard to conceive that the caliphate could have included, you know, Britain, France, Holland.
Or China. So at the same time as the Arabs are losing the Battle of Tours, they're also failing to break through into China.
Right.
And the limits of Islam, the push in towards China, parallels the failure to reach into Western Europe.
There's an interesting counterfactual, an Islamic China.
Right, but I don't think it was ever going to happen because it's
not possible,
In a pre-industrial age, you just can't reach that far.
Yeah.
But the Mongols, I guess, are the example. But then it all just...
But of course, the Mongol Empire leaves so little cultural and institutional legacy.
Yeah, so it's like a great tide washing over and then retreating.
Okay, let's do a couple of general questions.
So, Nick the Unready, here's one for you. What historical event which has taken place in your lifetime would you like to have been present at?
I think it would have been very good to be at the fall of the Berlin Wall.
Yeah, I was thinking that.
Wolves winning the Sherpa Van Trophy in the late 1980s,
of course. Historical event.
Gosh, what else?
I think the fall of the Berlin Wall. I mean, that would have been amazing. It's the obvious one.
Because most historical events, of course, are terrible.
Are grim. I mean, I wouldn't have wanted to be 9/11 or...
No, exactly.
You know, invasion of Iraq or anything. That would be awful.
No. Well, no,
but
I can't.
The collapse of the Iron Curtain would be...
Seriously, I'm going to die of a coughing fit from laughing. There. But I mean, the idea of you being swept up in the invasion of Iraq, Tom, it's very...
But you know, Dominic...
Sobering.
I have actually been to Iraq, of course.
You have been to Iraq, I know.
Old Iraq hand.
Yeah, an older Iraq, like Rory Stewart.
Like Rory Stewart, exactly. Me and Rory.
What about this question from Ruben, who's in Cape Town? Who do you feel is the most influential sidekick in history? Hephaestion, Mark Antony, Agrippa, John the Evangelist, Samwise Gamgee, and Thomas Cromwell were some people I had in mind. Tom Holland, surely it's the answer.
I saw that joke coming like an enormous lorry hurtling towards a hedgehog.
Well, Theo was saying it first.
It was so obvious. I thought, should I make that joke? No, I'm not going to. And then you went in.
Yeah, I did. Go on, who do you think?
The most influential sidekick.
Agrippa is a good call, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, I think...
Though Augustus would have succeeded. No, well, he needed a military man, didn't he? You need
a consigliere, don't you?
Yeah, you do.
Well, I'd go for Agrippa because obviously I'm biased in that, but there must be some killer answer. I mean, all the viziers that we were talking about.
Yeah. Sorry, Arthur is in this podcast. He says maybe somebody who has set up to the assassination of Franz Ferdinand.
Or maybe Jack Ruby.
So a sort of Gavrilo Princip number two kind of. I mean, Himmler is a sidekick and he kills a hell of a lot of people.
Yeah, actually, that's a horrible...
Or Beria or somebody like that, you know?
Yeah. Oh.
Anyway, that's kind of very bleak.
Actually, I mean, yes, in terms of influential, that's not a bad call, Himmler.
Oh, that's a terrible answer. That's a depressing answer. That's not what Ruben wanted.
No, it's not. But it's... But
when he's suggesting Sam Gamgee, he didn't expect us to go in with Himmler. Yeah. The rest,
it's a grim morning in Bath.
The rest is history. Never afraid of the darkness. Okay. Who is the most boring British Prime Minister? That's from Isgithen.
Well, I think potentially Keir Starmer, don't you?
Oh, he can be terribly boring.
I mean, he's very dull.
Yeah, he is.
But I quite like dullness.
Arthur shouting Stanley Baldwin from the other side of the room.
Oh, getting barracking his father.
But of course, Stanley Baldwin isn't boring, as we've discovered, Tom.
No, he's thrilling.
Because of his habits of sniffing books, marrying a cricketer.
Writing pornography
at school.
Yeah.
I mean, Alec Douglas Hume, I think, is quite boring.
Oh, he played first class cricket.
I knew you were going to say that.
That's not boring.
He's still boring.
No. Don't be ridiculous. Because you might say John Major, but John Major has a deep hinterland.
Yeah, John Major's not boring.
He's another great lover of cricket.
A music hall man, a son of the music hall, son of the boards.
Yeah, I mean, because the joke is he's the only person to have run away from a circus to join an accountancy firm.
Exactly, yes.
But had clearly hidden depths.
Boring prime ministers.
I mean, there must be some kind of 18th century guy
we've never heard of. I think that's the thing. Viscount Goderich.
But even they would all be, you know, drinking port and...
They would.
Gambling away.
I think actually it's quite hard to be that boring a prime minister because generally you've had to advance by succeeding in the bear pit of the House of Commons and winning the loyalty of your colleagues.
Yeah.
And I think if you're genuinely boring, that's quite hard to do.
Because I suspect Keir Starmer isn't boring in private. People say he's...
A great laugh.
A nice guy.
So Chris Floyd, who photographed us, a friend of the rest is history, he's photographed Keir Starmer.
Was he boring?
He said he was quite boring, but nice, but very guarded.
Well, there's a difference between being
boring
because you're boring and being boring because you're nervous of saying something that will prevent you from becoming prime minister.
Yes, that's true.
To pursue a cricketing analogy, Dominic.
Yeah.
It's like you're into the 80s, you want your 100.
Yeah, you start playing.
You don't open your shoulders, you play very solidly, you play.
Yes.
And I think that's where Keir Starmer is.
Yeah, maybe. I think there's an argument that boringness is a really underrated political tool.
Mm.
So that people who, you know, ordinariness, we talked about this in the past with Stanley Baldwin, but it's also the case of Major with Harold Wilson, James Callaghan, people who their political persona is about saying to people, you know, you're sick of the sort of high and mighty political class. The good news is I'm just like you. I'm normal. we could do with some normality in politics.
But this doesn't, does this work in America?
Charles Ford that was kind of veers into,
let's get rid of all the elites. I'm against you. I mean, that results in Trump.
I mean, Reagan, when he ran for governor of California in 1966, I'm a citizen politician. I'm not an ordinary, you know, I'm not a professional politician. I'm just like you. I mean, he never was actually just like you. I mean, François Hollande did this in France and the French didn't like it because he got all wet at his inauguration.
Yeah, but I was thinking about the episodes we did on the German chancellors and then the French presidents and then Australian prime ministers. None of them were boring.
No. My favourite one of all those characters is the guy who stole the tape recorder. When he died or something, his obituary said he was a liar and a cheat.
Every Australian prime minister, without fail, has
been a character. Right, Tom, we have to go and catch a train, unbelievably.
Okay, all right.
We also, I know you're desperate to have a quick scheduling meeting.
I am. So we're going to have our scheduling meeting.
No, we're not going to do that live. Theo's looking really depressed.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, thanks very much for listening.
Yeah.
We hope you've enjoyed the background hum of this rather nice hotel in Bath.
Yeah. It's been a slightly snatched and impromptu bonus.
It has. Yes,
this
it
week.
Has.
But we will return to normal service next week, won't we, Tom?
We will.
We'll be just about to record our Hammersmith show when we do next week's bonus. So that will be exciting. And then we'll be gearing up to our...
Go to Australia.
Antipodean Odyssey.
Like Captain Cook.
And we hope
you're all enjoying Captain Cook.
Definitely. There's been a lot of grief about when with the penguins in Canada.
Yeah, I don't know where that came from. Absolutely, you know, just don't at me. It was Dominic's fault.
Very good. All right, on that bombshell, we'll see you next time. Thank you for listening. Goodbye.